The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And this is Pollock and Thurston. Happy New Year, Brandon.
Happy New Year. It's a new year, and we finally have snow here in Buffalo.
We have gotten we got snow on New Year's Eve of all nights, and has kind of dissipated in the days since.
It's coming down right now in the last half hour or so, yeah.
This is a rarity that we have Buffalo and Toronto at odds when it comes to weather. No snow at all. We're actually above 0 Celsius today. So for more on the weather, stick around. Maybe at the end we will go through all of our changes over the past couple of weeks. But we have a lot to get to, Brandon, because to kick off Pollock and Thurston in 2024, not one, but two guests that you have lined up for us today.
Yes, we're going to talk to Phil Strom, who was at the press conference for World's End this past Saturday. And then later, we're going to talk to Chris Samsa about Wrestle Kingdom.
The Chris Samsa.
The Chris Samsa on Twitter, Wrestle Kingdom.
I cannot say his name without the like Kevin Kelly's voice in the back of my head, always emphasizing the. But we are also going to be joined, as Brandon just mentioned, by the Phil Strom, who was there. The Strom Scrum that we had on Saturday night following the World's End pay-per-view. Phil, thank you so much for joining us, and we will make sure to get all of your information out there because you did a lot of great work over the weekend at the press conference. This was, I would say, one of the more significant press conference AEW has held, given the allegations that had permeated throughout the day leading into World's End. And I want to just go back to Saturday and sort of just what you sense being there in the arena and the vibe before Chris Jericho came out, during, and after. If you can give us a sense of just the immediate reaction in your area that you were situated at.
Yeah, sure. First of all, it's great to be with you guys. Thank you for inviting me on. You know, on my way down to the arena, I took a train and I had somebody pick me up and drive there. And, you know, as I was looking at the news and as I was looking at Twitter during the day, I kind of saw what was developing with what was out there regarding, you know, the allegations regarding Chris Jericho and sexual misconduct. Kind of knew in that point that I, you know, probably needed to be brought up in the setting that I was in the scrum, if somebody didn't bring it up, that wasn't me. So, yeah, in the arena, you know, the reaction to him was what it was. I'm pretty sure it was audible over the air of people chanting, NDA at him and other things like that. And afterwards it was just, those scrums are kind of unique. Just that was my first time, actually at an AEW pay-per-view. Cause I had not been to the other one that was local. I think it was Newark last year. I didn't go to that one, but, so I kind of, who's in those scrums is kind of unique too, cause it's kind of a mixture of media and influencers and all sorts of other things in there. Podcasters, you know, all sorts of different levels of, are you going to get like journalism? Or are you going to get whatever? So, But I was aware of kind of what the the temperature of that was on Twitter and online, and what people were talking about during the press conference too, being able to check my phone during it. So, yeah, it was a unique day. I will say I wasn't terribly surprised by the answers that were given by Tony Khan. And the other thing I'll just say is that I think that the most important part out of what's going on right now is it's not necessarily about Nick Hausman, Chris Jericho, this one, that one. I think it's probably more important right now that we have an answer to the question of do employees, do independent contractors within these companies have a place to go if they have an issue? Is there a hotline? Is there an HR person? Something like that. Because Tony saying my door is open, that's great. And I don't doubt that at all. But at the same time, he's close to Chris Jericho. If his door is open and Chris Jericho is also on his staff, that still creates a bad kind of situation for whomever might be, giving a complaint. So that's kind of what I thought of the whole deal. It's been kind of a strange couple of days.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to imagine how somebody who may have a problem would be afraid to bring that problem up to their boss if they're not sure that there's really going to be an independent investigation into what happened.
And I think wrestling is so different than so many workplaces too, because I mean, if you look just even in the history of the business, it's always kind of been its own sort of, biosphere. Like, it's just been the decision makers make the decisions, and you're either in or you're out, or you're pissing off the wrong person. It's a different type of work environment, but probably one that needs a refresher for 2024.
Yeah. And obviously when a story like this is being adjudicated, and that's probably not the best word for it, online, you are going to get a lot of emotional responses, and it's going to be a lot of people that are just going to be throwing everything out there. And I think it's very important to sort of step back and look at what are the pertinent questions that come out of this. And I think that number one, I would state that this is one where I think we just want to know, is there something here beyond this? I don't think you can cast an indictment based off of Kylie Rae's one emoji post. But that said, she willingly volunteered something that at least requires follow-up. And to me, that would have been, if I'm AEW, something that at the very least we are contacting Kylie Rae and going from there. This is not calling for Chris Jericho's head. This is simply, what was the meaning of this? Let's eliminate the many, many questions that are out there, and hopefully we can find some way to get a semblance of what did occur or what did not occur.
Yeah, that's why the question that I asked, I just kind of got straight to the point of, is Chris Jericho under investigation, or was he at any time that he's been in AEW for sexual misconduct or any other type of misconduct? Just to, ask the direct question, not, a couple of other people wanted to talk about sort of the environment and that kind of stuff, which led Tony into the safety comments and that kind of thing. I just wanted to get to the crux of the matter of just, is this a thing or is this not a thing? But we still kind of don't even know.
And he didn't really answer the question. He said, as you said, he talked about safety and that AEW is the safest wrestling company in the world. He talked about how there's an open door to the discipline committee, which may have not existed in 2020 or 2019 when Kylie Rae was with the company. He talked about how, a lot about safety, and did not directly answer the question whether there was investigation at that time in 2020 or 2019, or whether or not it's something that they haven't looked into.
And I think that goes as well toward the point you made, Phil, is that if you're someone that is sitting down and watching that press conference, and I'm speaking more from sort of if you are somebody within AEW and this message is being sent that my door is always open, I think you could very much leave that press conference with the idea that Tony is not going to necessarily be pursuing this further. I mean, that was not conveyed in the sense that we are going to look into this. We cannot comment further, but obviously there is going to be you know, something that would lead you to believe that we are going to look into this. And if you're somebody that has that concern about, can I go to Tony Khan? You watch this press conference and may feel that, you know, this is something that is not going to necessitate anything further beyond these questions that we're going to take because we had a pay-per-view tonight and the idea that people will move on from this. And I can see people coming to that conclusion, whether that's fair or unfair on, on Tony Khan's behalf, but he did not lead you to that position that there's any kind of, you know, second step in this process for them.
And I think AEW deserves a lot of credit over time for the transparency that they have welcomed. Prior to them doing media scrums, we really weren't seeing a lot of things open up to media, access to media, that, you know, necessarily people like us would have. So, you know, hopefully some of this questioning leads them to kind of maybe look at their own internal, you know, machinations and figure out, all right, how do we make this a better workplace for, like I said, employees, independent contractors, for people to be comfortable? Because that, you know, one thing they have done is that they have kind of supported a very inclusive kind of workplace, and one that seems, at least from the outside looking in, that it is a good place to work. So, hopefully, you know, some of these discussions can be, you know, constructive, and hopefully they can also sort of inform other areas of the wrestling business, because you know what? This stuff's not going to change. People still are going to need a place to go if something happens. And, you know, if they can kind of lead on this, then great. But, it seemed like there wasn't really a solid answer right now for what that is, or, you know, when it would happen
as well. And maybe I'll throw this up to you, Brandon. You know, Chris Jericho has obviously not commented on this. He has not stated anything publicly since this came out. Just for transparency's sake, I have reached out directly to give him the chance to, you know, provide a statement or respond, and he has not responded. You know, if you are Chris Jericho, I think tonight will be telling if he is on the show, and if he is, number one, on the show, number two, if he is there in front of the arena, and what kind of reaction it elicits, and if it is back to the usual. I mean, this is sort of like what we have seen in a lot of cases, is that the news cycle does move on from this, and that is a strategy that is put into place in a lot of these. And like, we don't necessarily have the mechanism to necessarily see, like, it really comes down to just if there is a controversy that they feel there is a need to address versus just continuing onward as if nothing was happening. And that was obviously the plan on Saturday, because that match was structured in such a way that it was like there was not one change that was going to be altered based on the fact of this story that had been brewing all day long.
Yeah, and for one thing, it's at a pay-per-view, so maybe you want to say that there's more hardcore and more aware, internet-aware crowd there, you know, at Nassau Coliseum. But I would not expect him in front of the live crowd, at least tonight. I would kind of expect that they're going to try to lay low and see if this will blow over so it doesn't have to be dealt with further.
And I think, too, like, you know, I am not doing a lot of writing these days. I have a weekly podcast that I do, so it's kind of incumbent upon, you know, the folks that are doing wrestling journalism a little bit more than I am in 2024 to kind of follow up on this as the best as they can. You know, I'm in that room that is a bizarre setting in those scrums where you're trying to figure out where your question fits into the format that you're getting. I was trying to wait for just Tony to be up there only because I didn't want another talent with him that had to awkwardly sit there beside him while I'm asking the question about this, and either have to sort of look like they agree with him or not. Like, it's not a good place to put the talent in that case. They're not really the ones that need to be answering. Tony is. So, and also, I mean, you literally in those press conferences have Toni Storm in her hat and glasses get up that she's putting on Tony Khan. Like, it's a mixture of hard news and like performance art, which is unlike most scrums or in like sports media that I've ever been a part of.
And what happened was Toni Storm gave him the hat and he put on the glasses too. And then when Julia Hart was out, he still left the hat and glasses on and took a question from a reporter about that didn't name Chris Jericho and didn't name Kylie Rae, but named just asked about workplace safety or something of that nature. And he proceeded to answer the question with this hat and glasses on. Eventually, I mean, you saw it firsthand. Maybe you could tell us more about what happened there. But eventually, Adam Hopkins, who works PR for AEW, came up to the table after he asked that question, right? And after he answered that question and took the glasses and hat from him.
So, yeah, he brought some water over. And then Tony, I think, even said like that he didn't even realize that he still had it on his head.
Yeah, it just strikes me that he was not self-aware enough to realize that when you're answering a question that's related to sexual harassment, sexual misconduct in the workplace, that maybe you shouldn't be wearing a funny outfit when you do that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure this image was going through Adam Hopkins' head of what was going to be coming out of this press conference. And it was, I mean, not like the headline coming out of this press conference, but I think it just, it does underscore just what you said, Phil, of like in a nutshell, what these press conferences are. Like it's part theater and it's part serious. And we mixed the two together. And this was the ultimate Venn diagram of seeing an extremely significant, serious story being addressed in with this comical display on hand for everybody.
Yeah. And I've worked in news for roughly 20 something years now. And it's awkward for me to walk into a press conference where people are applauding because it's just not, I mean, if anybody's ever been in a press box or, you know, a media scrum type situation, the first rule of those.
You're talking to two non-applauders here.
Right. The first rule of that, it literally says sometimes on the press boxes that you're in, number one rule, no applause. So like I can show my appreciation in other ways for what's happening, but I'm not going to sit there and hoot and holler and clap. Not everybody in that room is in the same realm all the time. So it's a little bit strange. Even on some of the WWE ones that they've done, it's awkward because they come up on the stage
there's
and they're
applause
like,
why there too.
Why? But the wrestlers at times when they're not are like, mm-hmm. why aren't they cheering for me? This is weird. Cause they get a full entrance with the music and everything like that at WWE. And it's not the right setting for it. If you're making a legit like media conference.
Yeah. And I think it is something that like the PR people who are standing off to the side will lead, like they'll clap as somebody comes out. I think both in the case of WWE and AEW, I mean, that doesn't excuse it, but I think it just speaks to the lack of experience that a lot of people have in that situation.
I didn't notice it. To be honest with you on Saturday, I didn't notice to see if there was anybody. I just wasn't doing it myself, so I didn't see who was like leading it or not. But I think one other thing to note too about those scrums is that like I saw somebody mention that like, oh, and they turned Kevin McElvaney's mic off after he asked that question. They didn't turn it off. Like you ask the question and then you hand the microphone back to the person who handed it to you. So yes. If you've been given a follow up, look, if you're still exchanging with him, it's just that you don't have the microphone in your hand anymore. It wasn't that they shut anything off that he was doing. They handed back the microphone after he was done asking his question.
And so people know this is kind of what happens on the media calls too. You get to answer your question. And as soon as you're done talking, you get muted. I have been unmuted now twice.
Yes, this happened to you last week.
I've been unmuted a couple times now when Tony has decided to ask me a question in response to my question, but that's rare.
And then sometimes the mute button also malfunctions too. I've seen that happen plenty of times also where people are attempting to be unmuted and can't. So
I'm curious from your standpoint, Phil, especially having like the news background that you do. And I mean, this is certainly something that I think has escalated, you know, post speaking out, is sort of the mechanisms that we have in place when it comes to the handling and reporting of stories such as this. When you're talking about a lot of wrestling sites that are independent sites that do not necessarily have the backing of newsrooms, that do not have the legal support in cases like this, I mean, where just some of your broad thoughts on where like the wrestling media's role in a lot of these stories and the fact that many of them, they do have to come forward from the person in question that is going to address this on a platform like a Twitter or a third party.
I think the most important thing for all of those sites to consider is, and I know it's come up a lot of times about wrestling media, is that by and large, a lot of what you end up with in wrestling media ends up needing to be through anonymous sources. which I completely understand from a wrestling perspective, because it's a lot of times the only way that you're going to get something.
That said, business, brother.
Right. That said, on my side of things, working in media for the last 19, 20 years, whatever it's been, I can count on one hand and still have fingers left the number of times that I was allowed to use an anonymous source in my own work. So it's weird. It's weirdly counter kind of intuitive for me, but I understand completely why it's like that in wrestling. But I think that the people reporting on this need to be careful of who they are getting their information from. And is that source someone who will have firsthand knowledge of whether something happened or not? Because what you don't want to happen is wrestlers and people within wrestling talk all the time. What you don't want is somebody that has a specific axe to grind, whether it's in media or in the locker room or something like that. Wrestling is very competitive also. You want to make sure that your sourcing is solid. And even if it means talking to 2, 3, 4 people about the same thing to make sure that you've got it right, just get it right. Because if you have it first and you're wrong, you're not first.
How do you feel about if PR, if the public relations representative of a subject gives you something on background, how often would that be reported in sort of mainstream news? Because this is something that I think we deal with sometimes in wrestling.
It's interesting. I can't say that I've gotten that a whole lot at all in wrestling, just for my own, you know, what my interactions have been. I think it really just depends on the sensitivity of the topic, and how big of a deal it is. Because, you know, I can even think of things in news where somebody says that, okay, well, we're going to give you this, but you have to hold it for an embargo for tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. And you let them know, look, if you want to tell me what this is, tell me what this is, and then I'll determine with my editor whether or not we're going to honor that or not. But you don't determine to me when I break news. That's me. That's our news organization that does that. So if you really want to tell me to give me the heads up that something's happening, great. But I don't think that, I think you need to keep as good of an arm's length as you can with that kind of stuff, just so it's not, you don't want to become an arm of the PR. You need to still, and I've said this a couple of times lately, but wrestling is important to cover because it is a multi-million, multi-billion dollar industry, as you guys cover obviously in depth all the time, and it needs checks on it. And, you know, I think people lose sight of that sometimes, is that's why the media function is so important in wrestling, because it's so many jobs. It's so many independent contractors who can't really go somewhere else who are held to the position. So I think it's just, it all comes down to, you know, the media needs to hold these companies to accountability and not be the PR arm for them.
I think in this case, getting back to the specific story at hand, it's largely going to be into those settings that this is brought up again, that this is still front of mind for people. And ultimately, if we hear more from Kylie Rae, like, again, she put this out there and has not removed, like, again, we can't read everything into that. But it opens the door for questions. And I think that's where we're at. And it's a tricky one, because in many of these instances, we at least have a clear, like, allegation that is put out there of, this happened to me, these are the circumstances. And here it's, at least from the direct source in Kylie Rae, like, we don't even have that at this point. So this is a very unique one in that sense. And Chris Jericho is, like, he has to have his side out there too. And he can ultimately do that when he so chooses.
And I think, you know, you mentioned some of the speaking out stuff earlier too. With that, it was just kind of an avalanche of stuff. And it was all sorts of allegations of all sorts of people all over the place, but they did have most of the time names attached to them. With this case, you know, I don't even know. I mean, we had the emoji. Is there somebody else that has a similar situation within AEW or somewhere else. It's hard to even know because nobody's come forth, to even corroborate the original part of this too. And the fact that Jericho himself is not even really accused of anything officially yet, because there hasn't really been a formal kind of what happened here. Like, there's certainly no, crime or anything like that, or you can even go with on that. So it's an accusation at best, but it's an accusation that isn't even necessarily coming from the accuser, which makes it even more difficult.
While we have you here, I mean, being that this was your first AEW show covering it, can you just compare sort of just the environment versus a WWE show? Like, certainly we have seen now the introduction of press conferences at WWE, but just your, like, aside from this, which was obviously overshadowing everything at the press conference, other takeaways just from the experience of covering this event?
AEW does a great job on their pay-per-views, and that's really their calling card right now. I haven't covered any WWE pay-per-views from a media standpoint either. I've been to a lot of WWE pay-per-views over the course of my life, but I've never in a particular media role. But the pay-per-view itself, wrestling's fun and I can enjoy watching it. So from that side of things, it was really good. I think there were a lot of questions people were left with at the end of it, whether it was about MJF and what he's going to be doing for the next several months, where everything's going with that. Obviously Eddie Kingston's win was pretty exciting to see in person. But I've been to a few AEW big shows before. I went to all the Grand Slam shows, and I've been to one Dynamite. I've been to one Collision outside of that too. Just never something that had the official media thing attached to it. So their shows are enjoyable. I think I like a pay-per-view better than like a Collision, especially right now, because the Collision tapings are just so long with the Ring of Honor before and after it. I went to one in Newark that was nearly 6 hours long, and I like wrestling, but eventually even I get tired of it. So,
What time did you get out of this press conference at on Saturday night?
2:15.
This was like a 2.5 hour press conference.
I was kind of ready for it to be long. Luckily I had a ride back to where I was going from my brother, but, I think we left Nassau Coliseum at 2:15 a.m.
Unlike Brandon, who did the ultimate trip after Forbidden Door of driving home to Buffalo after that press conference.
I mean sitting there for 2 hours. I wonder, like, you notice the difference too when you go to a WWE press conference, or if you just watch. If you're going to watch them right after the PLE is over with, it starts immediately. And in the case of the AEW press conferences, I think you guys were sitting there for about 45 minutes because I was sitting there waiting for this to happen. And I think it usually does take around 20, 40 minutes. And I think part of that is tied to the fact that Tony wants to sit next to each talent while each one goes through and takes questions from the media instead of just doing his one-on-one time at the end. Which on one hand, it's nice that he's there and available for everybody to ask as many questions as they want. And he says things to that effect that he wants everybody who wants to ask a question to ask a question. Mm-hmm. But it's, you end up being there, especially if you have to get your credential at like five Eastern or whatever, you end up being there for like 9 hours or something like that. Cause the pay-per-view is five on its own.
One thing that might be useful for them for future media stuff. Like I remember I covered the WrestleMania. Oh gosh, what was the one in New Orleans? The WrestleMania 30 press conference, which was at the Hard Rock Cafe in Manhattan. It was on actually the WWE Network, and I sat next to the camera and I didn't even know I was sitting next to the camera. So my reaction to everything was live on the WWE Network that day. Like my laughter, my inquisitive face, everything was just live on the WWE Network. But with that, they just kind of whip right through. People say what they need to. If there's a couple of questions, they take them. But after that was over, there were individual media availabilities with the wrestlers and certain people. I only went to that one at 30 because Michael Cole is local to where I cover. So I did a one-on-one interview with Michael Cole after that was over. And that was pretty much the only reason I went there anyway. It was just to get the access to him. But I think if you had that where you just kind of like kept the actual presser brief and then just allowed access to whoever needed to, like sort of like a locker room, sort of like post game sort of thing. If you could make that happen, I think it would just be a lot more friendly for the people watching at home too, because I don't think I want to watch, like I haven't watched back Saturday yet and I probably don't want to.
Yeah, I'm always curious from some of the talents, even this many years into it, that go into the press conference and what their mindset is in terms of like what this is. I think you could ask the different performers and they'd probably have different answers for you in terms of what they treat this as this is just an extension of what I was just doing out in front of an arena. Or you get someone like a Brian Danielson who, I mean, it's like pretty transparent at these press conferences and you get a lot of insight from somebody like him. And I'm sure they're not really given much direction either. It's sort of just go out there and answer these questions however you see fit. And if you want to treat this in character or out of character, that's fine by them. But it does create this bizarre atmosphere where sometimes we get angle shot and sometimes we're addressing very serious topics such as Saturday.
That's wrestling too, though. You know, even, you know, having dealt with wrestling media for a while, you never kind of know what you're going to get with each individual talent and how they're going to either be prepared for it or not prepared for it. Some of them are very, very protective of their personas and don't really like going out of character that much. Some of them don't want to be in the character at all if they're talking to you just as a regular human being. So that's kind of wrestling. And I think you kind of grasp that early on, is that you kind of have to have a feel for it when you're asking the question of what, I mean, it's the reason I didn't ask Toni Storm a question. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any idea how I fit into what she was doing. Like, I didn't know what to ask. So I didn't even try. So.
Well, Phil, we appreciate you being out of character for the last half hour with us here on our show to kick off Pollock and Thurston for 2024. And I do let all of our listeners and viewers know where they can go follow Under the Ring and any other places you want to direct them to.
Sure. Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations drops every Monday. It's one-on-one interviews for the most part with me and other people in wrestling. There's the link for it right there. You can get it where you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, that kind of thing. It's also produced by USA Today Sports Media Group, which is wrestling junkie, MMA junkie, that kind of stuff. This week's episode is actually a New Year's edition with Vic Delicious from The Now, who's a great guy to break that stuff down. Next week, we've got Paul Burchill on the show, which should be fun.
The Pirate. I look forward to it.
Not anymore, though.
No, not anymore. But going back several years with Paul Burchill. But Phil, thank you so much for joining us. Great work on Saturday. And overall, it was great to have you on the show.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for the invitation.
All right. Thank you, everyone. That was Phil Strum joining us. And we're going to just keep it on going because now, checking in with us, he is the Chris Samsa here on the eve of Wrestle Kingdom 18. Chris, welcome back to the show, a now two-time guest on
Paul. Hello. Thank you, Chris, for having me. The what eve, I don't know, the afternoon of, right? We're I'm in the countdown mode.
Well, tell me what your plans are. How are you like, what is your sleeping schedule ahead of Wrestle Kingdom? Are you just going to be going straight through from the moment this interview ends until the end of Sonata and Naito?
I always like to say that I'm going to get a nap in or rest throughout the evening. But I don't. I haven't, for the past, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years that I've been trying to get up and do this thing live. So no, I'll probably be up. I'll hang around. I've got, you know, got some construction happening at the house, so it doesn't exactly, give me a lot of restful time in the afternoon. But yeah, so I'll probably hang around. I'll be tweeting frantically probably through random things that I continue to dig up in the stats and info world. And, I'll order my pizza from my pizza place at about 12:10, which is about the last time that they'll take an order. And it'll probably arrive here about 12:30, just in time for the Rambo. So, and then, yeah, we're just up all night. I'm already on my caffeine drip, so I think I'll make it.
And for people who are listening in audio only, you are wearing, is that the official
New
Japan jacket?
Yeah, I got the 2024 New Japan tracksuit prior to my little media tour this week. So I feel very official. Got the 2023 hung behind me as blocking my wife's desk as she asks me to do whenever I do video. So,
are you like an official, like member of the New Japan broadcast team in a sense?
I am not. I am a, I guess I'm officially on the periphery of the New Japan broadcast team. So, but I have a tracksuit fairy that likes to send me the official, digs every year. So sometimes they arrive prior to the Wrestle Kingdom tour and sometimes after. It's always a better year when they, arrive prior. So we're on a good trajectory already.
And do we have a two-man team with Walker Stewart and Chris Charlton on the broadcast?
That is my understanding. Yeah, I don't believe anyone else is joining them tonight.
Yes. Walker Stewart, of course, is the recent addition to the New Japan broadcast team, replacing Kevin Kelly. And I think that alone will be notable right there, because, you know, their English broadcast strategy has been something that has, you know, continued to evolve over a number of years at this point. And this is a big transition for, I would say, for a lot of casual New Japan fans that are going to be stopping in for this show that maybe have not checked in since the G1. And I guess as you look towards this, what would you say is grabbing the most attention in terms of the star power or match that you feel is going to be attracting the most fans this year?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it's pretty varied this year, actually. Last year, I think, Will Ospreay and Kenny Omega did a lot of the heavy lifting, especially kind of in our section of the world. And, you know, this year with, Kazuchika Okada versus Bryan Danielson sort of in that same spot, I feel like it's not quite giving it the kind of PR lift that you would imagine, that a match like that would give, probably because it's a rematch, mm-hmm. potentially because the first match didn't really, land the way that I think that they had kind of anticipated that it would, the injury, you know, et cetera, things like that. We've kind of all talked that to death, I'm sure. So, but I think as you go through the card, right, like the lower end of the card has a lot of kind of what I appreciate, which is some of these new guys that are coming up. You've got a special singles match between Yota Tsuji and Yuya Uemura, which should be both a great match, but also just something establishing for the future, right? So we're looking forward. We've got the New Japan World Television title in the second slot on the card, and that's Tanahashi versus Zack Sabre Jr., which is sort of this classic matchup, but I think we are seeing the elevation of Zack Sabre Jr. So I think something worth noting is that, you know, he's one of those guys that could very potentially carry sort of the English language fan base for a little while. Like, potentially he's that next top English language speaking guy. So I think, curious to see what happens with him here, if this is an opportunity for him to drop that title and elevate, as in the New Japan community, we like to call that the classic losing up. Happens all the time, especially on big New Japan shows. So, and then, you know, obviously as you go through the rest of the card, you've got some classic matchups. The junior heavyweight title match is Hiromu Takahashi versus El Desperado. That's just, it's this long standing rivalry. It doesn't need a whole lot of extra story to be told. And then, of course, the main event, right? This whole show is really about Tetsuya Naito, and will he win, and does he get to finish the roll call, and the Los Ingobernables roll call at the end, and who does he include in that roll call, right? So if you're looking for sort of the story beat from the main event, kind of running under the assumption that Tetsuya Naito is entering as a heavy favorite, it's a little bit more about what happens afterwards and what is set up going forward. So, New Japan's been in sort of a transitional phase, and I think that we're finally over the hump and we kind of see who's going to be sticking around for a little while. So this is, it's a great showcase of who's going to be, kind of a part of the company for the next, you know, year or two.
And no better person to preview that main event than Keiji Muto earlier this week on the New Japan website. That was just what an astounding read this was of Keiji Muto, just really wanting to separate you from your dollars to make sure you are plopped down to see the effects of a wild New Year's Eve sonata.
I've been sober for almost 10 years, but even when I did drink, I don't think I ever had a 3-day hangover. So I think New Year's Eve is an okay open space for Sonata to let loose a little bit before hitting the ring for the main event.
Yeah, well, as Muto said, you know, he performs sometimes hungover, but never for the Tokyo.
Never the Dome, yes.
Bizarre, yes, of course. On the New Japan website, no less. How would you look at, you know, New Japan is in this interesting state, and I'm glad you brought up the Yuya Uemura and Yota Tsuji match, which I think is one of the most important matches on the card. And you sort of have the focus on like your future four, including like Ren Narita and Shota Umino there. that I think a lot of people are looking at as, you know, we saw many of their elevations, in particular Tsuji over the past year, and they're going to be called upon to be major players this year and beyond, because we're looking at a New Japan that there's the obvious questions that are going to pertain to Kazuchika Okada coming out of this show. There's, you know, Will Ospreay's pending departure. And then you have, you know, a John Moxley that is featured on this show. And like the makeup of New Japan could go through many changes in the months to come, where an Ospreay is only going to moonlight here every so often. And what is this main event mix going to look like come Wrestle Kingdom 19?
Yeah, and that's got to be the hope. The hope has got to be that that special singles match with Yota Tsuji and Yuya Uemura, and then that tag match with Kaito Kiyomiya, Shota Umino, Ren Narita, and then, of course, Evil. The hope's got to be that those guys are going to be the guys to carry the banner as we go forward and elevate up the card, or maybe there's a year-long story that gets told between Wrestle Kingdoms here. I have a lot of hope that some of these guys are either challenging for or holding titles when we roll into the Tokyo Dome next year. So, but yeah, I mean, we finally have kind of the next generation all present, all accounted for, all ready to go, all kind of in their new units with their new characters and everything going on. Some of those guys have had, you know, a little bit longer. This is Yuya Uemura's first singles match back since Excursion. So, that's very much a parallel to 2012 when Kazuchika Okada came back, and his first singles match after Excursion was against Yoshihashi at that Wrestle Kingdom. And then, of course, he challenged, Hiroshi Tanahashi after that Dome show. And then that led to the Rainmaker Shock, and the rest is truly history. I mean, it's the ascension of New Japan Pro Wrestling then. So I don't know that we have another ascension ahead of us like quite like that, but I don't think it's beyond New Japan to tell another version of that story with one of these guys.
Do you have a sense of what New Japan World subscribers are at now? As I was, you know, as we're sitting here talking, I'm looking back and I see 116,000 paid subscribers was what Bushiroad disclosed, which was as of January 2021. Okay. I don't know if you've heard of any number higher or any number more recent than January 2021.
I know that the last thing that I heard about subscribers was after last year's Wrestle Kingdom, which was when Mercedes Moné debuted. We had a ton of people kind of coming into the ecosystem, I guess. And if I recall correctly, I think they did reference that as a record-breaking subscriber number. They did some sort of press release or web post shortly thereafter. Since then, it's been mostly quiet. The easiest and kind of cleanest thing that I can find in regards to New Japan's business is generally ticket sales, and specifically Wrestle Kingdom or Tokyo Dome, big building ticket sales. And everything that I've heard, and I did ask around a little bit this past couple of weeks, is just how are ticket sales and what's going on, is that everything is ahead of last year's ticket sales, and they're expecting a pretty strong walk up under the assumption that Tetsuya Naito is going to give everyone kind of that great moment at the end of the show. So, I think if I'm kind of looking from the outside and reading between the lines, I think a 30,000 person dome tonight is a big success. It's a big win, and it kind of puts it in the range of what they were doing pre-pandemic, sort of. They had the big 2020 double dome where they broke 40 on one of the nights, but
last year's number, which was also a one show.
Sure.
Wrestle Kingdom, 26,085.
Yeah. So I think they're looking potentially at a 10% increase, give or take. I know that, you know, just anecdotally, I've got a bunch of friends who did travel over this year, and last year they didn't quite have the time to kind of put that trip together. So, you know, I think the traveling fan is something that I think they want to, you know, they want to get back. So I think that that's a good sign. So yeah, I think they're feeling generally healthy and confident. And I think that they've probably discovered some cost efficiencies. In certain ways,
we love cost efficiencies here.
Sure.
Just to add to the subscriber number. So I do find from 411 Mania here, the Wrestling Observer newsletter reported, this is a report from April, that New Japan had 40,000 new subscribers in January, and the most live viewing ever, over 90,000. Right. Total subscribers were around 150,000 to 160,000, this says.
Sounds about, I mean, that would be the peak, I would imagine, just based on kind of what I've paid attention to over the past 5 or 6 years.
when it comes to like those you interact with that make the trek over for this particular week, like, do you get a sense that people are going over? It's largely to see New Japan. Like, how much do like the Noah and All Japan and Stardom cards, like, do you get the sense that people look at this sort of like a WrestleMania weekend where, yes, the Tokyo Dome is bringing you there, but it's all these other shows that kind of are of interest to people? Like, what is the health, you would state, of like these other shows that we have and plenty going on this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very much a WrestleMania weekend sort of environment. There's a lot of shows from Noah to All Japan, Stardom. I mean, you name it, everyone's trying to run near the Tokyo Dome. And lucky them, there's a billion venues near the Tokyo Dome to run. So, yeah, I mean, I think most of the people that I know got there prior to New Year's, and then they have gone to, you know, multiple shows already. And they're kind of making the most of this big wrestling trip, and then also going out and seeing, you know, Tokyo or whatever areas of Japan that they choose to hang around in. So, of course, what's up?
Have you been to Tokyo?
I have not.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the invite. Okay. I'm waiting for the official invite.
Maybe that'll be the WrestleNomics post-wrestling road trip next year, or flight trip we can go on. Do we have an updated number, Brandon, from the All Japan streaming service to monitor the Charlie Dempsey effect?
I have not heard, but you can email me at Brandon@WrestleNomics.com if you have any tips on that.
Okay. That's, we will seek to find out the All Japan Pro Wrestling streaming service. As you look at, you know, the shift, I think it was largely taken positively, the reduction from two nights to one for the Tokyo Dome, but I certainly wouldn't discount the idea at some point of them exploring that again, even if it's an idea that we're not going to fill the dome two nights. But I mean, we saw, you know, with the pandemic, like, that second night really did give an assist to New Japan to, like, no one could have predicted what their business was going to look like over the next year. But I mean, do you have a preference at this point when it comes to assessing the two nights versus one?
I mean, one night's always going to be a better singular show. I think the roster is deep enough. I mean, there's so many great wrestlers out there in the world that are willing to jump in and, you know, work a New Japan show, especially a New Japan show at the Tokyo Dome. So you could fill it up pretty easily. But I think from a fan's perspective and from a public relations perspective, I think focusing all your energy into one night is healthy. I think that you're going to get more bang for your buck that way. And you're not asking for too much of people's kind of unorthodox time, right? So if we're thinking about the American audience, right, asking people to, I guess, either stay up all night or stay up late or watch early in the morning the next day so you don't get spoiled two nights in a row is much more challenging than, say, doing it just once, right? So I think that loading it all into one great show is probably the better move.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And then we've got, I mean, coming out of this, you know, we can expect probably some big angles at New Year Dash the following day. And then they've got to put together that whole Battle in the Valley card that is right around the corner on the 13th. They've got Nagoya on the 20th, and then Osaka February 11th. So it's a bunch of shows that I'm sure that they're going to be shooting angles for coming out of this. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see who are some of the key people coming out of this show, because there's going to be some like top positions that are going to be needing to be filled. And I think you hit it on the head, of Zack Sabre Jr., David Finlay, obviously, and then your Japanese talent, that they're in a position where I think you do need to fast track some people. And they've laid the groundwork, I would say, pretty effectively throughout this past year of sort of setting the table for this year to come.
Yeah. And I think the focus for New Japan Pro Wrestling, if, you know, from what I'm seeing is the domestic audience and selling tickets, right? So what we heard from new president Hiroshi Tanahashi was that his goal is to sell out the Tokyo Dome under his reign as president of New Japan Pro Wrestling. So, and that's the clear focus for New Japan. It's always been sell more tickets. And it was the same through the pandemic. And we saw that through hundreds of cards and buildings that were probably too big, but you wanted to maximize the number of tickets you could sell. And that's their revenue stream. So, you know, when someone comes in and like Hiroshi Tanahashi and says, we should put title matches in smaller cities and we want to sell out the Tokyo Dome. Like those are the two things. And both of those things lead to selling more tickets. So I think with that said, focusing on domestic talent with a lot less risk of, someone like AEW or WWE coming along and saying, we can pay you a bunch and you can live a different life than touring around Japan. For a guy like Will Ospreay or Jon Moxley, or even someone like David Finlay, who is kind of always in that conversation too. You know, the Japanese talents are the ones that are going to rise, you know, lift New Japan, I think, back up into the point where guys want to drop in, you know, or, you know, I guess regenerate their careers there as opposed to a place like AEW. So I think it is really important that those, you know, younger Japanese born talents are really the featured acts in especially a show like Wrestle Kingdom, where you're establishing kind of the next, you know, really the next year, the next set of stories.
And with the report, I think a couple of weeks ago that, Kazuchika Okada is possibly going to be represented by Barry Bloom, who's a well-known agent for wrestlers. Obviously Okada is on this show. He's wrestling Brian Danielson. What do we have an idea of like when his deal would be up with New Japan? Because I have the memory that a lot of these deals will expire at the end of the year, or maybe it is just after Wrestle Kingdom.
Right. So it's usually end of January or end of February for almost all New Japan deals, as far as I know and have been told, and you know, the wrestlers that I've ever talked to, like that's the timeline. So, you know, typically this time from Wrestle Kingdom through say the end of February is kind of what's considered New Japan contract season. So that's when those guys, almost everyone needs a renewal of their contract, because that's pretty much a guarantee for most of the, that they'll get an offer for most of the talent. But it's a matter of if they come to terms. Most of the Japanese talent, it's no brainer. They come to terms. There's a lot of loyalty. You know, guys with other options or guys that aren't necessarily, you know, born and bred in the New Japan system, they may be looking elsewhere. Or if you're at the level of Kazuchika Okada, or you're recognizing that you only have, you know, a certain window that you want to go and live in America or try that out, then of course, maybe the feelers are going to go out there. But, those conversations, or those, I guess, rumors have really quieted down, even within the people that I know had sourced those rumors, sourced the information. It sounds like things have calmed down, in relation and maybe in conjunction with Hiroshi Tanahashi being, you know, a really powerful representative now in the New Japan office.
Do you know, are they still doing the 1 year annual deals for most talent? Cause I remember that being a big issue with how way back, like Kojima and Muto were both able to leave New Japan in like 2002 at the same time.
Yeah. My understanding is that not much has changed in that way. I do know that there's special circumstances, certainly for guys like Kazuchika Okada or probably Tetsuya Naito, big top guys.
It's like maybe they had longer term deals than one
potentially
year.
And foreign talents, we know that Will Ospreay was on a 5 year deal where you know, that is expiring here in the next couple of months. So I think that there are certainly special circumstances, but I think the majority of the roster still has that kind of annual rollover situation,
just dangling Yujiro Takahashi out there for all the places to bid.
It seems like a big risk to like have a big swath of your talent. All their deals are going to expire at the same time if somebody wanted to raid you.
It's kind of like, hey, let's just turn the lights on and let everyone know exactly what you
it's get. We're my idle. Understanding is it's just sort of, and Karen Peterson's in the chat, kind of explaining some of this. So, and bless Karen, Karen's wonderful.
There we go.
So, but yeah, my understanding is the same as I believe Karen's, is that, you know, this is just common. It's how it works over there, right? I think the large swaths of money don't come in the same way. And like I said, like it's trickling in with ticket sales and things like that. They don't have big TV rights deals. So, you know, overcommitting the finances would be potentially catastrophic. So I think that this is just a way to accomplish what they need to. And honestly, it seems to have worked for the last 50 some odd years, pretty well. Every now and then you see someone make the jump that's surprising, but otherwise, you know, if the work environment is a positive and, guys are gaining stature by spending time in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which many do, you know, it'll still be a desirable place to go and practice the craft.
Yeah, it seems like what Karen's saying is this is common throughout the country. It's not just particular to the wrestling industry. With John mentioned Charlie Dempsey showing up to wrestle for the All Japan Triple Crown, and you know there's other things, and the discussion around, well, maybe will Okada go to WWE or something like that, and Nakajima just left Noah, right? I've read that Shuji Ichikawa has left. Who is he with?
He was with All Japan.
All Japan.
Yeah.
Does this make it easier for WWE to do something in Japan? Do you get any sense that that's in the works?
I mean, I think that there's always that chance. And I think that there's been a lot of different situations that WWE has clearly dipped their toe in or put the feelers out with. I know Noah was on the table quite a while ago before the CyberFight acquisition. And, you know, All Japan's a great name, but the lineage of All Japan doesn't necessarily tie exactly back to Baba and all that. So All Japan is a great run independent right now. They're one of the few, you know, wrestling companies in Japan that you kind of see on streaming services that is kind of held in some regard that doesn't have a major financial backer. So, is the door open for WWE to, you know, step in and do something? I would be silly to say no. So especially given that this Charlie Dempsey, William Regal, NXT, All Japan thing is happening. But, we're also seeing, you know, we're starting to hear some things in the background at All Japan that people who have been there for a little while are not happy with the situation. So, you know, I guess we'll see where it goes. Wouldn't be the first time there was an exodus from All Japan. So, you know, anything can happen.
I've put this cursed image of what looks like Corcoran Hall, Vince McMahon and Giant Baba shaking hands in the middle of the ring.
It'd be a fly on the wall for this car ride over.
Could you imagine?
My last question for you, Chris, is, you know, with the recent changeover, how do you think the Takami Obari era is going to be remembered? I mean, he came in replacing like Harold May, and this is like in the midst of the pandemic and such. I mean, how will this period be remembered under Obari's watch?
Well, I think the whole beginning of the Bushiroad period that kind of ends with Hiroshi Tanahashi coming into kind of leadership is it was all driven by business guys, right? Like guys that were very, very capable of growing a business, but not necessarily knowledgeable about growing, building, or maintaining a professional wrestling business. You know, there's things that are coming out now that Obari said that, you know, he didn't seem to care that Kazuchika Okada was willing to leave because he's just the lead actor in a touring show. And that's just not how it works in pro wrestling. You know, I'm sure you guys know that as well as anyone. Like the top stars sell the tickets. And if the goal is to sell the tickets, then you keep the top stars happy. And, you know, especially in Japan, when it's like the main event is 60-70% of the reason that people go to these shows. The actual cards, there's a reason that they're announced early. There's a reason that they allow for people to plan because, truthfully, like they're hitting the same city half a dozen times a year, but the big show or the guy in your favorite guy is in the main event, you know, you're going to buy tickets to that show and maybe you're going to skip the next tour. So I think that, having a wrestler in leadership is probably a positive, but to look back on kind of the business side, we've seen the numbers. Brandon has reported the numbers, like the business side growth, the nuts and bolts of that have been healthy. But I think, you know, to look back on it, it was almost in spite of, the great wrestling that was going on. Like nothing could have taken New Japan down during that period. So, you know, curious to see where it goes, curious to see what Tanahashi's role is and what he continues to say in that particular lane. So, but I think that the maintenance of the business was really important, especially through the pandemic. So maybe they were the right guys to carry New Japan through that, because they did have to, you know, tighten the belt a little bit.
Well, Chris, do let everyone know where they can follow along tonight. The Rambo, I believe, kicks off at 1:30 a.m. Eastern time, and then the main show an hour after that. The Rambo might feel like 4 hours, but it will only be about 40 minutes. Not always my favorite match of the show, but at least, I guess, cleanses the palate for what is to come after. But do let everyone know to be following along with the Chris Samsa.
Of course, yeah. What I will say is the problem with the Rambo is not the Rambo. It's the 20 minutes between the Rambo and the main card where, like, the risk of falling back asleep, very high. So be very careful with that. But yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at the Chris Samsa. I'll be live tweeting during Wrestle Kingdom. I will share all the stats and info that I sent to the broadcast team as the card goes on. So as each match hits the ring, you'll see something new get posted, as well as any kind of anomalies or random things that pop up throughout the card. Otherwise, you can find my full stats and info workup at sportofprowrestling.com. If you go to sportofprowrestling.com, it's the only thing you'll find on the page. It has taken over the site, so you can kind of follow along there or download the PDF that I sent off to Walker and Chris this morning, if that's a little bit easier for you to follow along with. So check it out. If nothing else, shoot me a tweet and I'll be awake, and I'll help you all stay awake with me.
He'll be up with his coffee and pizza and a one-man wrecking machine. He is Chris Samsa, who joins us to go over all things New Japan Pro Wrestling and beyond. And thanks so much, Chris. Enjoy the show tonight, and we'll be following along.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. Brandon, are you going to be taking in Wrestle Kingdom?
Well, what time is it starting? Eastern time? U.S. Eastern?
The Rambo is on at 1:30 a.m. Eastern, if I have all things correct. And the main show is at 2:30. Someone correct me if I'm wrong with those times, but I believe that's the start times.
What I have done the last couple of years is wake up early U.S. time, so I'll wake up at like 4 or 5 a.m., and I might catch the last couple matches.
Yeah, I've watched it live most years, but man, does it kick my ass.
I have watched it live, but in the peak of like – in the peak of New Japan, like 2016, the Omega Okada match in Tokyo Dome main event, I was up live for that and for the surrounding years.
Yeah, I'll be very happy when we have a distance between Wrestle Kingdom and Dynamite, because last year it was the opposite, where it was Wrestle Kingdom into Dynamite that night. Now it's the reverse effect of that. So that is what's happening. Did you follow it all along? I ended up watching the Noah card on Tuesday, and a lot of the attention was on Kota Ibushi's performance. He came in hurt. He left the match hurt, and it was a really sad performance against Naomichi Marufuji. Like, this guy, like all due respect, he had no business.
Went to the hospital afterward, right?
Yes, went to the hospital after. Looks like, you know, both. It seems like he had disclosed that he had like an ankle and hand injury going into the match, and he just, like, all that fire that you assume with a Kota Ibushi, it was not there. He, like, you could see he had not been doing any significant training in preparation, because he probably couldn't, probably doing very little cardio. He just seemed so, like, multiple steps slower than usual. And here he is doing like a 30 plus minute match with Naomichi Marufuji. And it was just really tough watch.
Yeah. I mean, we saw him in Blood and Guts, and he was a different wrestler there too.
Yeah. This, you know, he has not been the same since his comeback after the shoulder injury in 2021, and probably needs, you know, some significant time off. But anyway, that was an interesting story coming out of Tuesday. And before we wrap up, Kevin Dunn's leaving WWE, Brandon.
That's what I've heard.
Yes.
And it's official, in fact. We've got a report of a all-staff email from Nick Khan confirming it. So it is for real. The camera cuts are all gone now. Is that right?
Yeah. Back while we were all playing Pac-Man, Kevin Dunn was out breaking his back building this company before WrestleMania 1. I mean, could you ask for someone other than Nick Khan to write your exit memo?
I want Nick Khan to write my obituary. You know. Just
it'd be tough.
How great.
It'd be tough.
Yeah.
So yes, Kevin Dunn gone. Did you watch Raw on Monday? I mean, did you see any like seismic alterations to WWE?
I did have part of it on TV. I didn't notice any big difference, and I don't really expect a strong difference in the production. I think many of his philosophies are baked deeply not into WWE, but into AEW and into the, you know, the unconscious automatic nervous system of pro wrestling that, has come to know pro wrestling and WWE as one.
I think he's informed a lot of fans of how they consume pro wrestling, whether knowingly or just subconsciously. I think he has definitely had a significant impact, and certainly a guy that has many of his detractors that go with it. Over on the AEW side, they, you know, following Kevin Sullivan's exit last month, we've also got Raphael Morphy leaving for a role at the Barclays Center, Dana Massey leaving her executive position in the merchandising department, and QT Marshall, who is now accepting independent bookings on top of it. So it's some, you know, sizable turnover that you're seeing there, people that maybe are not the names that are going to generate like the largest headlines, but key people in behind the scenes roles. And even more important, are they going to be hiring from within or outside of these roles that need to be filled?
Yeah. And I mean, WWE has laid off a lot of people recently.
That's true.
In September, there were wide layoffs. There's another round of layoffs. I believe it was December. I don't know if any of the people who were laid off fit into these vacancies that have been created now. But anyway, another talent was, Andrade El Idolo. His contract came to an end for AEW. Mega Parrick, who Tony Khan at one point called the number two executive in the company, she seems to have moved over to do work for the Jaguars instead, which I think she was already doing for years. So a lot of changes to slightly to the talent roster, but to their executive team as well.
And one other story we wanted to get to, the Hollywood Reporter, quizzed a bunch of different analysts about various companies and their forecast for 2024. And they got Eric Handler of Roth MKM to look at TKO in 2024. And some of Eric Handler's thoughts for the upcoming year. He seems optimistic that Raw is going to get at least a 1.4x increase and feels that the market is undervaluing what this increase is going to be, thinking that it's going to be at best a 1.4x increase. So, I mean, we can, 1.4x, of course, that was the increase that SmackDown got, and seems to be, you know, he is optimistic about the Raw deal. And even more interesting is that he could see the UFC doubling its rights deal once it is up in 2025 with ESPN, which is, that was a $1.5 billion deal that they signed back in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a great sense of what the appropriate price is for this TKO stock, given it's combined with UFC now, and it started out at over $100. It's currently, what is it currently sitting at? Is this $79? And it's been down ever since, which I think he mentions, or I think it is mentioned in that article that you're referencing, where it was September 21st that the SmackDown deal was announced, and the stock, I mean, we've got September 21st marked on this chart right now that we're looking at in video, and that's the turning point for the stock when it goes down. And Endeavor went down with it until about October, when I believe that's aligning with when they announced that they're going to try to take their company private, and it has risen back up to be about even with where it was 6 months ago. But TKO well down. What's written in the Hollywood Reporter is that Eric Handler believes that that there's an even lower deal than 1.4 baked into the stock for Raw. If that's true, then if they get a 1.4 deal, we should see the stock shoot up. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think if they come out with a 1.4 deal, maybe it's roughly stays about the same. I'm sure there'll be some initial volatility in the short term, but, yeah, I mean, I'm expecting, I think we did our prediction show the other day and I said, yeah, 1.4 would be my prediction. It seems like the safest bet for what Raw will get, a 40% increase over their current deal, $265 million, which would put it somewhere over $300 million, I believe.
Can I throw out one scenario for you to give us a prediction on for 2024?
Sure. Yes. What's that?
Who and where is the news broken of the Raw domestic rights deal?
Well, who broke it last time? Was it CNBC? Did Alex Sherman have that? The SmackDown deal? This most recent thing? They put out a press release. I mean, they'll announce that there's a deal. I guess what you're asking is who will break what the rate
is. Do you think WWE will be the first to announce it? Or do you think an outlet will have it before WWE puts out, you know, they'll get the 5 minute jump?
That's up to WWE, I think, right? Like, is it in their benefit to give that scoop to somebody? Or do they just announce it themselves? if it's a good deal, maybe. Maybe that kind of tells you whether or not they're happy, how happy they are with the deal. Do they give that scoop out to somebody, to some, you know, outlet that they want covering them? Like, I don't want to say the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal had a lot of coverage of WWE in the last couple of years. Or, you know,
if, like if it goes to FX, like does Pat McAfee get to announce it on his show on ESPN?
If it's a good enough deal, yes.
Okay. Well, we will.
That's
we
good
will
pick, see that. Pat McAfee.
Okay, that's the outlier.
Media reporter Pat McAfee.
Oh my goodness, he's not having a great day. But we're not getting into that. We don't have to cover football controversies on top of everything else as it pertains to the world of Pat McAfee. But there you have it, everyone, all up to date. Big thank you to Phil Strum and Chris Samsa for joining us on this inaugural edition of Pollock and Thurston for the new year. And lots to come this year. Don't know what's going to be making news next week. I kind of like how the fact that we have learned, I think, without even communicating about this, Brandon and I have realized that we typically like book a guest like a day before because it's like, I don't know what's going to be relevant by Wednesday. This news cycle is wild, Brandon.
Yeah, so we booked both of these guests days in advance.
We did. We did figure these were going to be noteworthy even with the passage of time. But
yes, can I grab one of the chats from one of our listeners?
Oh,
here?
Let's do it.
Jumanji Hunter asks, "Do you want to change your predictions from WrestleNomics Radio regarding the WrestleMania main event, Brandon? Where I believe I predicted for the WrestleMania main event night 2, Roman Reigns versus Cody Rhodes. Given the events that took place on Monday night." I suppose what this listener is suggesting is that obviously it's going to be The Rock now.
We went this whole show. We didn't even bring up The Rock showing up on
2 million views on YouTube as of now.
And we don't have a number yet for Raw. Delayed?
No, we should be getting it this afternoon. I bet those who have access to Nielsen data itself can probably see it now. I'll probably have it later, but I do not have it right now.
It would be interesting. They were going up against, 2 bowl games, but I mean, you got 22 minutes of that segment, the majority of it featuring Dwayne Johnson. And I would imagine there was a big, big spike for that particular segment that, would have taken them, probably performed very well on Monday night would be my assumption. And as I brought up on Monday, I mean, it just creates a ton of fervor around Raw when you have all these different elements. Like if you have The Rock for sporadic appearances over this quarter, that you have CM Punk back in regular rotation. Like there's a lot going on. Not all that unlike, you know, back in 2018 when a lot of people looked at the fact that here was Ronda Rousey coming into WWE. And at that time, that was a very big deal in creating this buzz around the company. And I think they've certainly got that now, and it's not just contingent on one person, but they have, you know, there's a lot of excitement around the product, and having The Rock in there is definitely going to increase that.
Yeah, so I would look forward to seeing how his quarter hour does. My theory has been that, you know, we're looking at live plus same day viewership whenever we're talking about the ratings.
Yes.
And so that will include same day DVR viewership and probably until like 3 a.m. I think is the cutoff. Yes. So I think what we often see is when there's a segment that has a lot of hype and buzz, I bet you've got people who are not watching it live who see maybe on social media what's happening, go back on their DVRs and check it out, and then they get counted into the Nielsen data. So I would expect to see a big quarter hour jump. Can't rule out that Jinder Mahal isn't a big draw in that case. But yeah, and I think, I mean, Elimination Chamber, Australia, Perth, it's a big building that they're running. I know they have sold a lot of tickets already. I think somewhere around 40,000.
And did they not? They made the request. Did they not? About
you said that. I have not seen that.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look it up because off the top of my head, I thought you had actually stated that. I know it's been said because I've heard other people repeat it as well. But I will check on that one.
Maybe that's what the government is really paying for. They're paying for The Rock.
I guess you can't dismiss it out of hand. It just seems to be as though if you've got a date on The Rock, where are you going to maximize his impact? And is it going to be the February pay-per-view versus, you know, the 2 nights that we are building our everything around for the next 3 months?
You're right. So we have this from the West Australian. Tourism bosses make bold pitch for The Rock to come to Perth ahead of... was that Western Australia's WWE fight? So this does look like maybe the whole article is behind a paywall, but that the headline lines up with what you're saying there.
Yeah. So it sounded like when they made their pitch, like they just threw this in there of like, could this be possible? Not like this was a demand on their part, but I mean, you know, that did come to mind as soon as I saw this. It just seems to be as though this is like, this is, you know, it's an embarrassment of riches is what they have. They have almost too many main events for shows that they have. And I guess that's part of the intrigue too for your audience of now you have several different directions of where you can go. And that's going to increase interest for the Rumble and what they do in February and what are your destination points for Philadelphia.
I guess you think about it like this, like what does you take, you're going to do a Rock versus Roman Reigns match. What incremental value does that add more to? Does it add more incremental value to Elimination Chamber and this notion that we can drive economics to a municipality and drive hospitality economics and sure ticket revenue too? Or does that drive more to WrestleMania? That's maybe already going to be kind of maxed out. When the real bigger area for growth is with site fees as opposed to the WrestleMania brand and all the economics around WrestleMania, which are huge. But is that kind of maxed out? How much room for growth is there in that versus doing this really big match between The Rock and Roman Reigns that may help you make an argument to future municipalities about how great you can do for them and how great you are for their local economy?
And that's the growth area for them, are looking at these site fees and the idea that you now it does set things at a high level when you're, it's not going to be an apples to apples comparison that we are, you bid on a WWE premium live event, you could get The Rock and Roman Reigns. But I mean, to your point,
you just don't mention that in the pitch, I guess.
It's,
no, you don't mention what the main event was and what your main event is.
It's the brand that drew this, folks. It was
yes, Roman Reigns. The brand is a draw. The brand is a draw.
Acknowledge him. Yes. But you're right. Like it will look very favorable of what kind of business they can draw and tourism if you stage the match of that level at a February show, for instance. But yeah, it's an interesting debate of like how you maximize this. If he tells you, I've got one match here to do and I can give you 3 to 4 television appearances, how can we best set this in motion and get the most value for what could conceivably be the last Rock match you're going to get at this point, or at least have to be under the assumption could be his last significant match.
And just thinking about what the stadium capacity is of this Optus Stadium in Perth, according to their official website, their capacity for rugby is 60,000. So I imagine for a wrestling event, yes, big stage takes out a lot. Putting people on the field offsets that somewhat. So let's say you're at 40 now. You've still got 10, 20,000 that you could add if you put a big match on that lots of people want to travel in to see.
You don't see The Rock doing France in April for Backlash.
Maybe they'll move it to a stadium.
Could be a possibility right there. Well, on that note, everybody, we are going to wrap things up. Myself and Wei Ting, we are back tonight with Rewind to Dynamite. And on Thursday, up at postwrestlingcafe.com, we will have a review of Wrestle Kingdom 18. Bruce Lord is going to join us for that. So we will go through all of the happenings from the Tokyo Dome. And coming up this weekend, it is a free edition of WrestleNomics.
That's right. It'll be Sunday, live for everyone, YouTube. As I mentioned to you a couple weeks ago, now streaming on X, you can, as we are right now, in fact, we are streaming on Elon Musk's X. And if you reply, there's one comment right now, actually. If you reply to the live stream tweet itself, we do see it live, which is what we always wanted. Just not enough engagement on Twitter for all of our ventures. So that'll be live 11 a.m. Eastern Sunday, free for everyone, and solo edition.
Are you buying or selling on X in 2024? What do you think the fate of this platform is?
The price is pretty low right now, but the product not great either. So kind of a toss up.
All right. I'm rallying for a Threads revival in 2024. We'll see if it happens.
Okay. Good luck.
That's my prediction for 2024. And that's all I'm going to put out. Thanks everyone for joining us. We're back next Wednesday and every Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern here on the WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling channels. That's it. Goodbye.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.